place. From way back way, you know that I don't play. Streets not safe, but I never run away, even when I'm away. OT, OT, there's never much love when we go OT. I pray to make it back in one piece. I pray. That's why I need a one dance. Got a Hennessy in my hand.
Started at the bottom, babe. Now we're here.
Love Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah, well,
don't get me wrong, but all the Rat Pack is charming in their own way, but there's just something about him. He's kind of quirky and goofy, but he's just like, yeah, I like that guy.
Yes,
you
he
know
can.
and he's talented too. I mean, that he's just, yeah, anyways, I just think that guy would be like a really cool friend, you know.
Yeah,
he would just been like the coolest uncle or what have you.
That, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as going for an uncle, you want glass eye.
Yep.
Or like up close magic.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. One of those two.
some David Blaine action.
Oh, boy. Yeah, maybe that much. Boy, that's a eccentric individual.
Yeah, but you know,
he's so funny. You were telling me about the whole thing that's going on with Chris Angel and David Copperfield, or at least with Chris Angel, and
yes.
David Copperfield is just staying out of it.
Yes,
he's in a battle that he's not even in. And
yes.
I it doesn't surprise me, because the whole thing about this, the new sort of magician, is, except for Penn and Teller, of course, as well, is that you have to be like extreme, brah, and like Chris
yes.
Angel's, you know, got piercings and he's got the leather jacket, no shirt,
ridiculous hair.
Yeah,
and yes.
He looks like a bad like comic book character, and that's kind of and then the whole all the graphics for the show is this Ed Hardy tattoo paisley kind of thing, and Blaine has all that in his sort of iconography, or at least like the posters, or you know, just the
sure.
art for his show and his thing. But personally, like, he's just kind of a dude to me. He's
yes.
a dude that, yeah, I mean, he's tall and clearly he has a lot of money and time to work out, so it just, you know,
he's
takes care of his
guy.
Body yeah he's
yeah.
Like, I guess he's a good looking guy, but to me, I just, in his eyes, I see a kid who sat on his bed, you know, for 8 hours a day,
oh,
jog in, jog out, card tricks,
absolutely,
you know, yeah, right, and just doing all that, and you can tell. And we I don't know if it was just on TV or something like that, but he had that special a little while ago
mm-hmm.
where he interacts with all these like famous people, and he's very good at what he does, because when you're acting with a famous person or a person on the street, it's the same. He's the same person.
Yes.
But that person is still a little like a little off. You know what I mean? I don't think he's going to shoot up a school or anything like
he
that.
He talks
but...
about that. I feel like he addresses that.
Oh, he knows that he's but, off?
Yes. I mean, part of what they talked about with his persona is that he's a little bit of a maniac.
Well, and plus, anybody who can stand on top of a column for 2 weeks or something like that and
yes.
not talk to anybody, you have there's something about, you wouldn't expect a guy who's like, I'm going to be frozen in a block of ice for like 40 days. And they pull him out. You wouldn't think that he'd be like, hey, what's up, dudes? Did you catch a local sports team? Oh, boy,
no.
They were doing really good. No, but at the same time, he either is able to summon it, like a relatability, or he's
yes.
able, or he's just got this, he can compartmentalize.
Yes.
Literally his body, but also his mind, and that, like, now I'm the guy who's going to sit here in the desert while I'm pushing pins through my hands and feet, like, and then I'll, hey, what's up? Yeah, I'm at a party. Yeah, I used to date Fiona Apple, or, you know, whatever. Just, it's hard. I mean, I think it's a good skill of his, among his many skills, is to be able to do that.
I have a lot of respect for him. Now, I do. I think he's a great performer, and I think he's probably a pretty cool dude as
yeah.
far as magicians and endurance artists
yeah.
go and everything. And I think as far as all that, he might be one of the most quote unquote normal amongst them.
I guess.
I don't know if that's.
I feel like David Copperfield's pretty normal.
I feel like David Copperfield's kind of boring.
Whoa, we got a Chris Angel fan.
Throwing shade. I didn't say that.
No, I don't know. And I don't have nothing. I don't know how it works in the halls of David Blaine, Inc. But I do think that he probably doesn't do his own press, is what I'm getting at, because we all thought he was a big joke like 10 years ago.
Right.
And I feel like he's come back around a little bit, and I don't think he's changed anything. He mm-hmm. just keeps doing him.
Yeah.
And that's all fine and good. But if he had a little bit more savvy.
Yes.
That was Doug Henning's problem.
Uh-huh.
No, let's not get into that. I feel like the magic show, are we like pitching a magic? I feel like the beginning of the show is where we have begun to pitch, well, set the tone. But we have begun to, like, it's become a segment where we pitch new shows. And without actually making a theme and canonizing it a segment, it feels like that's what we do. I have an idea for a segment.
Yeah.
Hong Kong cinema.
Yeah, that could be definitely be a thing.
I mean, it's far overdue, I think, in terms of this being a nerd show, comic books and but movies and cinema as well. And I don't think that we've really talked about Hong Kong movies on the show. I mean, we've watched Hong Kong movies. We've never done like a segment where we go, hey, we're talking about Hong Kong. And I'm talking about like the real stuff, like pre, you know, 1997 handover to the Chinese, like the original, what you think of the boom of Hong Kong cinema,
right,
especially in the 80s and the 90s.
So like, what would this segment consist of? Like, what would the, how would this be different from,
well, we
like,
could do like a, you know, like a mass watch. Well, it wouldn't be, we could try to make it craft of services, I guess, but you're going to find that a lot of those Hong Kong films are super high rated. They wouldn't
fit
into the typical sub 50% on Rotten Tomatoes criteria for craft of services. But I don't know, we could get Movie Guru Tara, if she's available, and get together and we could just watch three or four Hong Kong films.
That'd be a lot of fun.
The problem is, here's the problem. How do you pick them?
Oh, I don't even want to be a part of that.
I mean, you could go by star, you can go by director, you could go by producer. I mean, that way you've got Chow Yun-fat, Jackie Chan, Donnie Yen,
sure,
Jet Li, Soi Hark, Ringo Lam. You could just go down the line. But even then, we're way past 3 to 4 films.
I've got a question for
you.
We
could do a poll.
There you go.
Here's something. Maybe we could put this to the viewers. They're not viewers. The listeners.
Yes.
And see what they think. But I think that we should do something like that.
Maybe
like
we
I said, we'll
do
keep
a couple
it,
of them.
Yeah, we'll keep it like post or pre-crash because, you know, after the late 90s, it kind of went all downhill. I guess Ip Man came out a little while ago. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Stephen Chow's still doing good stuff. But yeah, everybody kind of moved over here and it kind of fell apart.
Why is there no actress known for Hong Kong?
Michelle Yeoh is the first one that comes to mind for me.
Well, that's true.
But
there's not a lot of actresses, though.
Yeah, well, there are. I just thought of Michelle Yeoh. No. Michelle Yeoh was originally supposed to have the role of Teresa in Hardboiled.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The funny thing about Hardboiled, and this is not about Hardboiled, we'll do 30 seconds and then we'll just get on to what we're supposed to be doing, but is that that movie, widely regarded as one of the best, if the best Hong Kong action movie ever made. And John Woo's swan song before he really left and just started making American films that aren't very good. And it was a mess. The production was a complete mess. Like, they started shooting before they had a script. The screenwriter went out of town and died, like, when he was on vacation.
Oh, my gosh.
And couldn't complete the script.
Well, obviously.
Yeah. Michelle Yeoh had been set up to be the female lead, and she couldn't do it. And so they got this other lady. But once they did, they had to totally rewrite her character. And really the whole movie, because Woo said that it was going to be like a grittier, more realistic sort of cop drama that was not like The Killer and just sort of this out balls out action type thing. And of course, it became the most balls out. All the balls were out.
Yes.
Which is fine. Everybody loves it. But yeah, so and there was a lot of just like I said, there was no real script. Woo was in the film as the bartender, specifically because they had some other idea for like a mentor character to Tequila, Chow Yun-fat's character.
Yeah.
But that kind of fell through. And then Chow Yun-fat himself, I guess, suggested that Woo be in the film.
Okay.
Because he thought that meant that Woo wouldn't cut his own scenes. Like, Fat wanted that. He liked that idea of that character that would be a mentor because he felt like Tony Leung was getting all the real dramatic meat as the undercover cop, you know, turned gangster.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to have like more better scenes. And he thought, he's not going to cut himself on the film. So he's like, no, you should play that role.
That's funny. Huh?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's stories to all of these films.
Absolutely.
In addition to baby hospital exploding, all kinds of stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. But I don't know. Like, if we did that poll, that'd be good. Otherwise, I'd say that we would do good ones, but maybe lesser known ones.
Or ones that are specific
for something. Because Hardboiled is a gimme. I think even The Killer is kind of a gimme, but I'd really push for The Killer if we did a John Woo film.
Well, maybe we could do, like, maybe we could pick a couple different themes and do the
Well, you
got to
get
repeatedly.
A shooty one.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
A fighty one.
Uh-huh.
And then, like, a dramatic one.
Okay. I like that they're shooty, fighty, and then dramatic.
And drammy. Shooty, fighty, drammy.
Yeah, that's better.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we like to do on our show. I call it, it's 33% shooty, 30 Friday, and 33 drummy.
That sounds about right.
Drummy is the two hump camel, right? Or is that the one? I can't remember.
I don't know.
It doesn't matter. What matters is this is the Just Enough Trope podcast. I'm your host, Caliban, joined as always by my co-host.
Hi, I'm Mikan Hanna.
And it's a big show today. It's more show than we know what to do with.
Mm.
A show that starts with Sammy Davis Jr. and is going to end with Greg Rucka.
Yep.
Which
you figure that out.
Just on a color palette, you know, scale will take us all the way through. But that's the kind of thing that we like to do on this show is cover all the bases. And so we're going to be talking specifically today to Elizabeth Baer,
mm-hmm.
which is she is an amazing author. I'm overwhelmed right now by just thinking about the amazing interview that we did with her that is extremely comprehensive. And we talk about everything that you can imagine from her process to the kind of books that she writes, the kind of books she reads. And things like that. So
she has written a lot of books in a very small period of time.
Yes, she has.
Which is impressive.
Yes. And she is somebody who has read a lot of books. She's read more than any 10 people you know put together.
She reads a lot.
Yes. And there are some people who just, you know, there are people who's... I'm not sure where I'm going, but let's see how this turns out.
Oh, let's do it.
Whose eyes are like terminals, you know, whose eyes are like, you know, data ports.
Sure. Yes.
And... And she's like that, I think. And then her, you know, hands are the same way. So if you made like a
just
computer
taking in information and then putting it out.
If you like copied her brain and made like a computer program that was like the Elizabeth Baer program, like it would just the data would be crazy.
Would you call it the Baer?
Input output. The Baer. The Baer version 3.2.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll be talking to the Baer later on the show. And then it's Friday. We're going to skip the news again because we've just got too much show for you. So that's okay. Some stuff's going on here and there, but not too much. We'll get back to that on a later show. But we're talking comic books. It's Comic Book Club on our Friday show. And so we're doing something that I think if Baer isn't familiar with, I think she might enjoy.
I think she would
Or think it was cool because I think it has a lot to do with the kind of things that she writes about and likes. It is called Lazarus from mm-hmm. Image Comics. And it is written by Greg Rucka and illustrated by Michael Lark.
Yes.
And we read the first sort of collection, which is 4 issues. Before we get started, how are you doing?
You know, the holidays are upon us, and I always feel slightly overwhelmed, but I'm trying to also be positive and optimistic.
I'm a little excited about our holiday films that we'll be tackling on Craft Services this month.
Oh, I am too. I mean, I know we're doing Jingle All the Way next.
This Monday, Jingle All the Way.
Yeah.
And after that, we tried to do that thing where we pick films that are set at Christmas.
Yes.
But don't necessarily have anything to do with Christmas.
At least don't focus on it.
Yeah.
So much.
I guess Jingle All the Way.
I know. I was just thinking.
So we try. I did say we try. And we
didn't
want to
do
times.
All Shane Black films.
Yeah, right. Yeah. This is the non-Shane Black edition. And we came up with Jingle All the Way. After that, we're going to do Reindeer Games.
Yes.
Remember, these are all bad movies, so they all fit.
Yeah.
The Ice Harvest after that, which I think is a misunderstood movie, but we'll give it a shot. And then, it literally drops on December 25th, this show. So we're doing Santa Claus the Movie with Dudley Moore.
Wow.
And we're going to reach out of the Northern Pole, maybe the Northern Hole. Instead of going high, we're going low. But to reach out of that for New Year's Day, we're doing End of Days, which technically... is both a Christmas movie and a New Year's movie.
Perfect.
Because it's all about Advent. The Advent of the Antichrist.
Oh.
Kind of like in a Constantine.
Are
how
we getting
like,
ready for Trump? Is that what's happening?
See, you made it political.
I'm sorry.
It's sort of like in Constantine where it's like, yeah, the devil had a son too. Like, of course. It's like, is it of course? Or is that like a...
I know.
Just a thing that you came up, that a screenwriter came up with because he was on a deadline.
Yeah, and made it sound like... Of course, bro. Of course he did.
Yeah. if that has to do with competency porn, though. Because Constantine's a character who knows everything. He's always got the upper hand. You know, he's like Magic Batman, kind of.
Pretty much.
I gotta say, I enjoy competency porn as much as the next consumer, but I also like, I don't know what you call it, like dullard porn? I like a good doofus. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I like a character, like The Tick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or... Man, I can't think of a good example except for the only thing I can think of is this character that I played in a role-playing game for 3 or 4 years who I sort of set up as like, he was like a thief mm-hmm. and he was very charismatic and it was kind of like his greatest skill. but he was like a, you know, intelligence, wisdom, zero, dumb stats.
Sure.
And so he could lie with the best of them, but he couldn't, he didn't know if it was working, so he'd just keep lying. He never knew when to stop.
That's
and so,
an awesome character.
And so people, you know, would really be like, yeah, that guy is really great. I'm just a little, but yeah, he's so fun.
Loose,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's great.
Really smile when he's around.
Yeah. And just, I don't know, the virtues of the doofus, I think, is something that we don't talk about enough.
Absolutely.
The character that wins, or, you know, in spite of himself or herself, and doesn't even necessarily know that she's won. But we, you know, God's perfect idiot. We got to love fools and children. Or foolish children.
Yes.
That don't contribute to their 401ks.
Oh, that's a shame.
Is this left the rails? I don't think so.
Maybe a little bit.
All right, well, let's get back on the rails and do our interview here with Elizabeth Baer. We talked about her growing up and the sort of, how did I put it? The Justice League of science fiction fans that sort of raised
yes.
her to be who she is.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, let's not give it all away. Here it is, our talk with Elizabeth Baer. We were on a panel together at Convergence this year that dealt with classic ambulatory journeys in film and literature and things like that. And I think that you walked away with it, no pun intended, because you're amazingly well read. You had all these excellent examples. When I saw I was going to be on that panel, you know, I thought, okay, well, everybody's going to think of Lord of the Rings. Where do I go from there? And you had so many interesting things that actually led me to go check out some of the stuff that you talked about. So where does that come from,
well,
you being so good, well-read?
I can't remember any of what we said on that panel.
Yeah, it was really late. I can't either.
the buffer, you know, like the panel buffer fills and you do the panel and then the panel buffer drains and it
right.
fills for the next panel and you have no idea what just happened until you
exactly.
read about it on the internet.
Exactly.
So I actually... grew up with the ideal background to become a science fiction writer both of my grandfathers and both of my parents were science fiction fans and they all had different taste.
Oh, wow.
So I was a voracious reader as a kid and everything that was around the house to read was science fiction or fantasy.
Sure.
And my paternal grandfather was into, Howard and Lovecraft and that sort of stuff. Mm. And my dad liked Jack Vance and my mom liked John Varley and Ursula Le Guin and her dad was very into Asimov and Heinlein.
Okay.
So
that's like a Justice League of like sci-fi and fantasy fans.
I know. So so basically I grew up reading, you know, wildly age inappropriate science fiction.
right. Well, that must.
And this is what happens.
Yeah, that has to have contributed to your sort of ability to sort of elide over different genres and genre conventions. Like, I'm interested in your bucking of the conventions of normal genre and sci-fi and fantasy. How much, when you write, are you calling upon your influences and writing something like the things that you or your parents or grandparents were interested in, and how often do you think you're creating something that's sort of new, even for you and your experiences?
Oh gosh, that's a tough question.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, we're the product of our influences, and
yeah.
sometimes I wind up discovering that I was responding to an influence without even realizing it.
Mm.
Or, you know, like I'll spot, be reading a favorite author and spot something they do and be like, oh, I do that.
Sure.
And so there's this thing that Barbara Hambly does, which involves stringing together two predicates with the same subject, basically. So it's like he walked down the stairs, comma, out into the street. And I totally
sure.
do that.
Sure.
I do that exactly. And I'm reading one of her books. I'm like, wait, I do. So this past summer, I was reading Jack Vance. And I'm like, he does that. I'm like, aha, that's where she got it from.
Sure.
So, you know, you keep tracing the influences back realizing that there's basically nothing new under the sun. We just steal from each other generationally.
Oh, sure.
Some of us more consciously than others.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times what I write, I think, I mean, I really came of age in the 1980s, and a lot of the stuff I was subjected to as a kid was that bizarre 80s techno fantasy, post-apocalyptic, what's the word I want, aesthetic, that there hasn't really been anything quite like since.
Like cyberpunk and that sort of mishmash.
Well, sort of, it's sort of cyberpunk, but it's also fantasy, you know, these sort of Krull and Metal Storm.
Yeah.
Thundar the Barbarian, the classic Thundar the Barbarian. All two seasons of it. It just kind of, I think, like, got into my RNA and influenced my gene code, and it tends to creep out if I'm not doing anything else, if I'm not consciously suppressing it.
Sure. We were sort of on that subject. We were watching the Ghost in the Shell anime movie recently, just because we're sort of gearing up for the live action movie to come out. And I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, they've really thought about it. They've really built this world here about this technology. But they got it totally wrong. I mean, not that it's the point to get it right, but this would all be biopunk now. Like, we're not going to want to put, like, robot lasers on our heads. Like, we're going to be changing our bodies with genetics and things like that.
I am currently rereading Neuromancer.
Oh, okay.
And I'm only, like, two chapters in. It's holding up fairly well, although there's some stuff that I sort of go, wow, so that's really how we were thinking.
Yeah, right. And
I also reread Snow Crash a couple of years ago. And the funny thing is, it made me realize something about writing. Because I read Snow Crash roughly when it came out, which would have been like 1991, 1992 when I was in college. It was getting passed around my university science fiction club, you know, one dog-eared copy with the cover falling off.
Yeah.
How we read everything when we were broke college students. I remember thinking at the time that it felt really incredibly futuristic and like bleeding edge. Right. And now I look at it and I go, wow, this book is so 1990.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So intensely. But I think that that's, if things are like really futuristic, they just feel weird. Uh-huh. You get into that, like, Philip K. Dick, trying to read Philip K. Dick in, you know, 1978, and it makes absolutely no sense. And then you go back and read it now, and you're like, wow, this guy was ahead of his time.
Yep. You know? Yeah.
So I feel like if you're actually writing something that's up to the minute, it feels bleeding edge.
Sure.
And if you're really in the future, then people are just kind of look at you and blink like cats.
Right. Just goes over their heads, yeah. Do you think of yourself as a prognosticator when you're writing sort of futuristic sort of work?
Oh God, I hope not. I'm feeling a little too psychic right now. Actually, I'd like to go back in time and rewrite some novels, please.
Right.
I am very proud of, like, the one thing that I got right was smartphones.
Okay.
There's something very much like smartphones in my cyberpunk universe, which I actually started writing in like 1994, although the first book wasn't published until 2004. So
sure.
I didn't call them smartphones. I wasn't that smart.
Right.
I'm claiming that one, damn it.
Yeah, you can have that one. Sure. We'll just grandfather the smartphone title in there. Do ideas always come to you as a part of a specific genre, or do you sometimes have a premise and you have to try to slip it into a setting later?
Sometimes. So right now, the thing that I'm working on is a time travel murder mystery, and time travel stories are just brutal.
Yeah.
They're so hard to do well. I don't know what I thought I was doing. how did I get myself into this? And I've been stuck on this thing for years. I had been stuck on this thing for years because I'm like, I can't figure out how the mechanism for the time travel works. And I was kind of thinking of it as a fantasy story. And then I realized, well, no, I'll just make it a science fiction story. And I'll do the Back to the Future thing. And there will be, you know, an eccentric inventor.
Sure.
Which
solved everything. So I was trying to write it in the wrong genre.
I'm curious as to what you're using or what sort of style of time travel you're using. There's this sort of Back to the Future kind of, you know, you create a new timeline or you disappear from the photograph. And then there's the sort of other kind that's kind of my favorite, which is usually everything that has been done has already, like every second is kind of a simultaneous now. And so any changes you've made have been made, and trying to change things means you're just creating the reality you're coming from. It's sort of the paradox proof one.
I'm kind of doing a combination of those two.
Okay.
I don't want to give too much away.
Oh, no, of course not.
It's supposed to be a surprise, but what I find tremendously irritating is I ran across a book a couple of years ago, and I'm not going to name any names,
okay,
where it's one of those and the time stream heals itself time travel stories,
sure,
except for the first instance. Like, so guy goes back in time, does something, it changes time, and then time can never be changed again. And I'm like, I really am mad at you, author. I take this very personally. Scott and I actually just saw Arrival, and we were having an argument in the car on the way home as to whether the time travel element in that was valid or not.
Okay. So. Interesting. Well, you had mentioned that you had started, you'd been writing as far back as the 90s. And I think I read in your bio that you'd been a lot of things, media industry professional, the girl that makes the donuts. But what was behind your decision to just drop it and just go write full time?
Well, okay, so actually I started writing fiction in second grade.
Oh, okay.
a lot of people seem to start when they're 13 or 14, and apparently I had to be different. And I figured out that, like, books came, you know, how that you have that epiphany in your childhood where you figure out that food comes from somewhere before it comes from the supermarket.
Yeah, sure.
Like there's a supply chain. I figured out that there was like a supply chain for books.
Right.
That people made them. And I have no idea how I came to that realization, but yeah. I didn't. Like, that's what I want to do. And well, I was going to be, you know, like an author, firefighter, spy, astronaut, physicist.
Sure.
Jockey, race jockey.
On the weekend, yeah.
1 out of 6 isn't bad. So I had spent most of the 90s, at, you know, my post-college era, trying to figure out how to break into print and not really being good enough. Also trying to figure out how to finish a novel, which it turns out is really hard. Like, the first third is easy, and then you get to the middle, and stuff actually has to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really daunting. And then eventually, like, my brain myelinated or something. my cognitive development completed itself sometime around age 30, and I started finishing things, and then I started selling things, and it's not so much that I decided to become a full-time writer as that in 2001, 2002, the economy took a serious downturn and I couldn't find a job.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was writing a lot to fill the time in between, you know, doing my sending out my job application so I could keep getting my unemployment and going to job interviews that never went anywhere.
Right, yeah.
And basically sold a novel before I found a full-time job.
There you go.
I was still working part-time for a while, and then eventually it got to the point where you hit a point where you can't actually physically do both.
Yeah.
And how fast you hit that point depends on how old you are and
right.
How many other life responsibilities you have.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And how demanding your day job is, and you know, how many book contracts you've signed. And so I sort of hit this point where I'm like, you know what, I'm just not – I am not going to try to find a job anymore because I can't do it. I'm going to die of stress.
Well, it's scary, but it must have been really encouraging for you as well to make that realization that it's like, I can't keep chasing this job that I don't really want. I'm going to have to actually do the thing I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I had spent my entire life convincing myself that, well, you know, nobody actually makes a living writing books, so I'd better always have a fallback position.
I'm interested in how your background, or how you think your background has influenced you. I mean, you talked about having a lot of sci-fi and fantasy books around the house, and having studied anthropology, of course, if that has influenced you in any particular way. The donuts,
Well, I mean, the donuts have influenced my dietary choices because I was a broke college student working in a donut shop, which meant that I ate an awful lot of leftover donuts and things. To this day, sweets have very little allure for me.
I see.
And I still like an occasional cookie or something, but I've been ruined for donuts. I mean, the anthropology definitely has a lot to do with it. I can't think of a better educational choice for somebody who wants to go into writing science fiction.
Interesting.
Because, I mean, the thing that undergraduate anthropology, the first 2 years of undergraduate anthropology are designed to, you know, break people they're designed to alienate the heck out of you, basically. Make you feel like a stranger in your own culture. And once that happens, you can never really go back. So I think it helps me write characters of various different backgrounds with various different life assumptions, not without judgment, but with less judgment and with more critical engagement of where they're coming from and less visceral sort of ideas about what's right and wrong, you know, and engage with the ethics of people who are not like me. That's super helpful, honestly.
What's your process when you write? Do you have an ideal environment?
Ideal environment is basically at home, undisturbed, with an endless supply of tea and preferably a cuddly kitten who is sleepy and not playful. However, sure. I've written in all sorts of environments. I got the warning early on not to sort of ritualize my process, because if you start attaching rituals to writing, then
I've got to have this hat on, or I won't be able to do this.
Right. Yeah. I've got to have this hat on. I have to be able to smoke. I have to have. Cory Doctorow tells a story about how at one point he had gotten himself into this thing where he had to win 2 games of solitaire in a row before he could start writing.
And he's wow.
I need to break that habit because you can waste hours.
Yeah, that's sometimes it's hard to even just win one game. So
yeah,
I
know.
I can
exactly.
imagine, too.
It's a great procrastination tool, though. writers are the greatest procrastinators in the world. I have gotten so much house cleaning done when I was supposed to be writing.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing is ever dusty until you sit down to write.
Right, yeah. That's one of my personal problems is that I don't know if it's like a defiant disorder or something, but like I can never do what I'm kind of supposed to be doing. So I try to trick myself and like give myself something else to do so I can do the thing that I don't really want to do. But now I kind of want to do it because I don't want to do the other thing.
See, I've been trying to do the rewarding myself for writing thing, because what I tend to do, the mistake I make is I get hypercritical and I'm like, oh, nothing I do is ever good enough. It's never quite enough work. It's never, you know, I didn't write enough words. They weren't good enough words. I'm like, just shut up. Have a cookie. You know, you sat down and wrote for an hour. Here's your reward.
Right. you've got over like 20 books in the course of 10 years or so as a professional author. In writing those, you must be writing these at the same time. How do you keep them straight? Do you ever work on one thing, do something else, and come back and go, where the hell was I? What's going on now?
I actually need a lot of gestation time.
Okay.
So often what I wind up doing is I will write whatever like the first chunk of idea that pops into my head and a whole bunch of notes and maybe bits of scenes and bits of dialogue and whatever, and I'll stick that in a file and I will stick it in my, because I am old, I still have all of my writing files arranged in a good old fashioned, you know, like tree directory.
Sure.
like we used to do back in the era of DOS. And
right.
So every setting has its little file folder, which has little file folders for every story in that setting. And
wow,
it's terrible. It's I'm really not a visual person at all.
Okay.
And so I have my little file folders, and I put stuff in there as I think of it, and I just sort of let it gestate. And when I think of stuff, I will add to it. And I need to give my brain downtime. I have this natural impulse to like fill all of my waking moments with stuff that feels productive. So if I'm like taking the dog for a walk, I feel like I ought to be listening to an audiobook or listening to podcasts or whatever. And it turns out that if I do that, I actually stop being creative because I'm not bored.
Yeah.
It turns out that the whole storytelling thing is something my brain does to keep itself entertained when I'm not giving it enough to do.
And we've killed that with smartphones. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So staring into space, trying to come up with some sort of thing to entertain myself by thinking about, I need to make that space. And so things like washing dishes or driving long distances or going for walks or actually when I do a lot of my productive thinking and then I, you know, like run home and scribble it in a notebook or, sometimes I text it to myself. And stuff builds up, and then either because of an encroaching deadline or because the story has gotten to the point where it starts pushing at the edge of my head, I sit down and actually start to write it. And I have a lot of chunks of stuff that sort of need to be put together into a sensical order.
Sure.
And I mean, sometimes I have something fairly close to an outline, and often when I get stuck, I will sit down and outline. But I very rarely write something rigidly to a predetermined outline. Sometimes I will sit down and write a very detailed outline and then ignore it completely. but I feel like we've really kind of divided ourselves with this false dichotomy of, you know, pantsers versus plotters. And I think that most writers really fall somewhere on a continuum. Maybe it's just me. I can never do anything the same way twice. So
that's interesting.
It's more of a challenge that way.
Yeah.
What is your opinion about ebooks versus like physical books? Do you have a strong opinion either way? Do you have a preference for when you read for fun?
Not really. You know, I travel a lot and ebooks are great until your phone dies.
And I know that terror.
I have had a couple of dedicated e-readers, and the problem with them is that they become just one more thing to lug around. So now I generally do my e-reading either on a tablet or on my phone, and the advent of little light portable external batteries has made that a lot more doable on like long flights and stuff. But I am one of those people who's really incapable of not reading any text that happens to land in front of me. So the stereotypical person who reads the cereal box, you know.
Sure.
Or you know, the Dr. Bronner's soap bottle, which is like the best thing to have in the shower because it's reading material.
I'd have to wonder about a hypothetical kid in the future who has a similar situation to yours where his family or extended family are all sci-fi readers, but it's not evident necessarily. Like, I wonder if he would find himself in a similar situation to yours, because I'm sure just toddling around your house and seeing amazing vistas, you know, the crazy artwork on these 60s and 70s sci-fi books, the same thing when you're just swiping through like an ebook.
I mean, the house I grew up in was literally paperback stacked three deep on shelves.
Sure,
you know, I mean, just I don't know. I'm kids' books, obviously. A lot of them are still because they're large format and brightly colored, you know, and have a lot of really lush illustration.
Yeah.
That seems to, I mean, those books are there to be handled. And kids are obviously super comfortable with like tablets and phones and things.
So I
feel like the stuff is still there. What I think maybe sort of missing in households that are largely e-reader. I mean, the way I operate is I buy a lot of stuff in ebook, and if I really like it, if I want a physical copy to keep, then I wind up, you know, buying, I refer to it as insulation, you know, books have a high R value.
Right.
And that way I can, but also like physical copies are easier to flip through if you just want to read a particular passage.
Sure.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
You know, you can kind of like flip it open and find a page and read a little bit in a way that is harder with an e-reader. You have to search on a specific thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. So I feel like the thing that maybe kids won't get is they won't get that exposure to the libraries of everyone around them. Because, especially in stuff that's DRM'd, it's not just shared throughout the household.
Yeah.
Unless somebody has gone to the effort of like stripping the DRM off it or is buying from one of the publishers that does DRM free ebooks, and therefore they are, you know, available to everybody in the household without having to like swap a tablet around or hand somebody your Nook or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
do they even make Nooks anymore?
I don't think
they do.
Yeah. I have one.
I know they're not selling super well. So.
Yeah. And the same thing with audiobooks. They used to be on tapes, right? And you'd just like loan them to friends and stuff. And now it's through your Audible account or whatever. And you get it and you're the only person who can listen to it.
Right. Yeah.
Unless you burn it to CDs or whatever for a car trip. And I feel like that's probably bad for the spread of readership and for, because you get books by contagion, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, read this. It's cool. Right. Like the entire history of my taste in literature.
Right.
So... on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of stuff available free online and the online zines now. So I notice a lot of like, dude, read this. It's cool going on in the short fiction world in ways that it didn't necessarily used to.
That's cool.
Sure.
Just hearing you mention CDs, it just even burning CDs is so outdated now. It's like talking about a Victrola or something like that.
Now I just like play stuff via Bluetooth through my car. My car is a peripheral for my phone.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, speaking of world building, I'm interested in hearing in how you research, because you've created worlds both historical and futuristic. But when you research, how do you kind of organize things, keep things together?
Oh, God. I mean, I read everything I can get my hands on the topic, and I take a lot of notes. And I will type things into that sprawling, for lack of a better term, outline document that I was talking about. But then when I actually sit down to write, I tend to ignore a lot of that stuff because like the important bits stick and become part of the fabric, like the flavors get in there.
Sure.
And I feel like what you want to avoid is what the Turkey City lexicon refers to as the "I suffered for my art and now you will too" syndrome.
Ah, where, sure. Yes.
Where every bit of research you've done on this, whatever topic this is, is never going away.
you talked about Snow Crash before, and that was a little like that for me with the Babylonian mythology elements. I think Stevenson's got a lot better about integrating things like that, but there were just clear areas where it was just, he just wanted to show off how much he had read about this, like these info dumps.
I really read a lot about Babylonian mythology. Yeah. It's like, and I would compare that to like, Roger Zelazny's Lord of Light comes to mind.
Sure. Yeah.
As obviously he read an awful lot of Hindu mythology.
Yeah.
But it sort of gets baked in, you know. It's not. It's spread evenly through the batter. It's not all clustered at the bottom in lumps. Sure. I've been watching The Great British Bake Off. Can you tell?
It's a great show.
Mary Berry is my patron saint. I want to be that when I'm 83.
Let's talk about mythology. I mean, it's clear that it's important to you, and you use it in a lot of your works. But how did you first get exposed to mythology? And do you have a favorite myth cycle or area?
God, obviously we got the Greek myths in school, but I just never really attached myself much to the Greek myths. I never cared much about them.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, raised by wild pagans in the hills of northeastern Connecticut. So I got a lot of sort of mythology info dump as a kid.
Sure.
Wound up doing a lot of reading. And I actually, it's not a particularly exotic mythology by Western standards, but I am very attached to the Norse myths.
Sure.
My grandfather was a Swedish immigrant, and but he was of the generation where you didn't really talk about, you know, the old country or you assimilated. And even though obviously he was a Swede born in Finland, even though obviously Sweden and Finland have both been Christianized for a very long time now, that was sort of a way to get to know some of the relevant history for me.
So you got a lot of ideas, clearly. You have written a lot of books. Are there any ideas that you tried really hard to realize, but you just had to finally let go?
I've got a bunch of stuff that's sort of sitting there, you know, waiting for the right day, or has gone by the wayside. Sure. I'd written a proposal for a diesel punk story set in a sort of alternate 1920s, 1930s New York City with a forensic pathologist protagonist. And it just, you know, and domed cities and magically poisoned wastelands between them. And and it just like never, I couldn't, it was too weird. So I wound up actually writing it up as a setting for a game universe.
Oh wow!
But I don't think I will ever get to write the book. Sadly, it's something I might do on my own time if I had any of my own time, which I don't.
Yeah. A lot of your work contains social problems and social issues that the characters or the societies are dealing with. Do you make a conscious effort to sort of tackle those ideas, or is it just organic to the story that you're telling?
Well, I'm really interested in ethics. And somebody or another once said that the New England Gothic, if you will, the writers of the Northeastern United States, our literary tradition is not comedies of manners, but comedies of ethics. And I think that's
okay,
pretty true. And I'm probably part of that tradition.
Ethics, you know, punk.
Yeah, from Hawthorne on down, that's what we do.
Okay, I can see that.
What are the ethics of this situation?
Yeah.
And I sort of feel that, societal change is a great way to discuss that, is to put people into situations where they have to make choices where maybe there isn't really a good choice. And I mean, I also grew up in a non-traditional family, and I have spent a lot of my life feeling like there need to be stories need to be for everybody. I didn't have this kind of a name for it until recently, but it's very much the diversity in YA, diversity in science fiction movement really speaks to me on that level, because everybody deserves to see themselves in fiction.
Yeah.
And I so very rarely did growing up that it's important to me now to try to present as wide a range of people as I can, because I do feel like seeing yourself in fiction is very validating.
Yeah.
And that's hugely important. You know, it's like a recognition that you exist and you have a right to be here. And if you only see other people, then you start feeling like you don't exist in a weird sort of way.
How do you think the rest of the industry is representing that in terms of female protagonists, minority protagonists? Like, what's the health of it so far?
I think it's improving vastly. I also think that my generation of science fiction and fantasy writers and the generation immediately after us, because I've been in this business long enough now that there's a generation after me.
Right.
are increasingly diverse. And I think that that's a lot of what we bring to the table as a wave of science fiction, is that we are diverse, that we are providing different perspectives, interrogating narratives from different angles. And I think that's profoundly important and makes for a much more interesting conversation.
Sure. You collaborated with Sarah Monette on A Companion to Wolves and the two follow-up books. What's your collaboration process like?
Okay, well, Sarah and I have a collaboration process that works pretty well for us, but probably wouldn't work for very many other people. And basically, it goes like this: is one of us gets an idea and starts writing, and then sends it to the other one, and the other one goes, "Huh, okay," and then goes through and edits all of the first one's prose, and then writes for a while until they get bored and sends it back, and then the first person edits the edits and then edits the new prose and then writes for a while. And then eventually we get to a point where we're like, well, okay, we've set up some stuff. We should probably have a plot. And there's a point where I start getting antsy because there's not enough structure.
Okay.
And so I'm like, okay, well, here's the thing that we should start moving toward. And she takes apart all of my ridiculously complicated sentences that have far too many commas in them. I remove about 25% of her secondary characters. And a third of the adverbs, and that's basically it.
Do you have, what's your feedback process like when you write? Like, do you show your stuff to people and try to get feedback? I know that you're active on social media and you are communicate with your fans a lot. I'm just curious as to if you have an ongoing process or if you're just, it's a sealed door until you're ready with the manuscript.
You know, I the problem is that I actually don't have a lot of people who I'm trading works in progress with right now.
Yeah.
And I have been looking into recreating some of those relationships. I had a pretty good group of writers with whom we just sort of swapped around chapters and so forth. And we've all gotten really busy.
Okay, sure.
That's part of the problem, is just finding the time to write and read other people's stuff and have opinions about it. And
yeah, right.
Becomes really onerous. So I like feedback while I'm working.
Sure.
I don't always get it until the thing is finished.
Right, yeah. We were talking to Bull at this last convergence, and we were talking about the Scribblies and how that was so important, sort of getting that feedback and being able to see others do things and run your stuff by other people.
Yeah, and it's also inspiring, like when somebody is reading your stuff as you're writing it, and it's like, I want more, I want to find out what happened.
Right.
That's amazing. That's such a good reason, because you're like, yeah, and then they talk to you about it, and they're like, they're really excited about it, and they get charged up, and you get ideas from that, you know?
Sure, yeah. Speaking of Bull, any plans on revisiting Shadow Unit anytime soon?
Well, we have a deal that she has to turn in Claim, which is the sequel to Territory, before we can write any more Shadow Unit.
Okay, I see. All right.
Because her editor knows where I live. So.
Sure.
But we would like to do, you know, like the 15 years later reunion movie, and then maybe the cheesy spin-off series that only lasts about 13 episodes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Do you and Scott ever look at each other's stuff as far as writing goes, or does that not happen?
No, we do. Scott generally does not show his stuff until it's fairly close to finished, but I do give him feedback on it. I am one of his beta readers, and I love it when he has time to look at my stuff and point things out, because he's a very good critiquer.
Any chance on a collaboration between the two of you?
Not currently. We're both pretty busy.
We were talking about Goodreads before, and I'm just curious as to how you use something like Goodreads or something like Facebook to connect with your audience or to help promote your stuff, and how that's really changed. I think that your writing career sort of spans the not having that and now having that, and how that's kind of changed your process, what you do.
Yeah, you know, I'm really terrible at that stuff. I have a live journal that used to be like religiously maintained back when that was the social media place to be.
Sure.
And now gets occasional updates. I currently don't even have a web page, as I need to rebuild it from the ground up into you know, something more streamlined and focused. And that has been a matter of time, you know, a matter of there not being enough time. I have a newsletter that I send out. I have a tiny letter, basically.
Sure.
I have a Twitter account. I have a Patreon page, but none of it, you know, I hate the Facebook user interface so much that I find it very hard to use it for anything.
Yeah.
So I do have a Facebook author page, but I check it maybe once a month, maybe.
Sure.
And update it probably once every 3 to 5 months. I am a social media how don't, basically.
Okay. All right, sure.
I'm pretty good at Twitter. That's what I've got.
Yeah,
but, you know,
right.
I don't really feel like most of that stuff actually sells books. People don't buy a book because you, the author, tell them, buy my book, it's cool. They buy a book because somebody else says, oh my God, I read this book and it's awesome.
Yeah.
And honestly, what I use my social media presence for when I'm talking about books, lately I've been talking about politics a lot, which is also supposed to be a no-no, but you know what? If they don't like my politics, they probably won't like my books.
Yeah, probably.
I generally tend to talk more about other people's work than about my own.
Okay.
And I don't know. It's the reason that, I mean, like, the number one reason people buy a book statistically is because they read another book by that author and liked it.
Uh-huh.
And the reason after that is cover art. And the reason after that is reviews. And
sure.
Word of mouth, you know, counts as part of reviews.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, good word of mouth is the best you can do. So,
yeah.
And I have no idea why one book hits better than another. it's mysterious and wonderful.
Right. Probably like timing and a lot of other things going on that just like coincide to help make one book more. Yeah. I mean, it does seem like Twitter is a pretty popular platform for writers to use to like communicate with each other, but also to promote each other's books. I mean, do you find that the sci-fi and fantasy community is pretty good about that? Are people generally pretty supportive of each other?
Yeah, actually, I think in general they are. You know, it's the thing is that it's not a zero-sum game. Like, mm-hmm. nobody ever walks into a bookstore, right, and walks out with the book they meant to buy. They walk into a bookstore and walk out with the book they meant to buy, three other books by, you know, authors who were near that author on the shelf, something from the discount rack up front, and you know, the latest Nancy Drew for their niece.
Sure.
Because we're all addicts. We're all recidivists. If I just read everything in this house that I haven't read, I could probably get through the rest of my life and never buy a book again.
I understand that.
So, but between my to read wall and all of Scott's stuff that I haven't read.
Sure. Do you want to talk about your latest book?
Well, actually, my latest published book or the one I just handed in?
Oh, well, both of them. I was thinking about Karen Memory, though.
Okay, yeah. No, Karen Memory is it is a Weird West steampunk adventure story starring heroic saloon girls versus disaster capitalists. It's basically Leverage with bookers. It's competence porn and mecca and noisy cats. I think it's a hell of a lot of fun. I wrote that one just because I wanted to write something that was fun and delightful and playful and, you know, really in the tradition of, you know, the dime pulps kind of. And people seem to like it. The thing I just handed in is a book called The Stone in the Skull, which is a book set in the same universe as the Eternal Sky trilogy, Range of Ghosts et al., but 50 years later and on a different part of the continent.
What are you reading right now? You talked about all the books in your house you haven't got to, but I assume that you read all genres, but is there anything in particular that tends to rub you the wrong way? Like, for example, I've never really been able to get into alternate history novels.
I like some alternate history, but my problem is that I always wind up, when I've tried to write it, I always feel like, okay, so this one thing in history changes, and now the cascading changes render the entire rest of history completely unrecognizable.
Yeah.
So I've written one alternate history story. It's 6 pages long. So I'm like, and now I have no idea what happens. So I've written some contrafactual history, which is different. It's like history that's sort of like our history, but not really.
Okay.
And that feels much more freeing to me.
It's kind of weird that doing alternate history in terms of world building, you've got our world, but somehow it's even harder because you have to take our world and then you got to change every little thing because of the butterfly effect or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. It's I get totally tangled up in the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
My preferred genres for reading when I'm reading fiction are science fiction and fantasy, mysteries, thrillers, some literary fiction. I am not a huge fan of romances in general. Okay. And it's not, and I don't particularly like horror, and I have nothing against either of those genres. I mean, I wish I liked romance because my God, that's 50% of the fiction market right there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's just not, it's not viscerally satisfying to me. And
sure.
Horror is sort of the same way. Like the thing that horror does where it gives you that frisson of adrenaline.
Yeah.
I get enough of that in my daily life. But I did just read Stephen King's The Shining for the first time. I'm the last person on earth who was spoiled for The Shining.
Sure.
And I actually pretty much liked it. I was actually very pleased by the ending because he surprised the heck out of me. And I won't spoil it in case there is one other person in North
America. There might be one.
know what happens. I just finished reading Octavia Butler's Kindred. Apparently I'm on kind of a classics kick currently.
Sure.
I'm also reading Poul Anderson's Space Viking.
Okay.
And which is a really old book.
Yeah.
And what's the other thing? Oh, I'm reading a book called A Brief History of Seven Killings, which is about Jamaica, Kingstown in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And it's so hard to read. It's an incredibly good book, but my God, is it depressing. So I've actually been reading it for like a month and a half now, because I read three pages and then I have to go read something uplifting.
Yeah.
Octavia Butler novel about slavery.
Somehow that's more lighthearted.
So that's my current reading list.
One kind of story that I have always liked is generation ship stories. I don't know what it is.
Those two somehow.
Yeah. You wrote a trilogy, yes, about a generation ship. I'm not sure what it is, because there's, especially when, and this is something else I was thinking of. When I say generation ship story, I mean generation ship gone wrong. If a generation ship doesn't go wrong, there's no story. You know, something, you know, goes wrong, and then of course everybody goes nuts. Like this Chris Pratt, Jennifer Lawrence movie that's coming up pretty soon, Passengers, features a generation ship as well. So
yeah, I'm actually I have an idea for a generation ship story where things don't go wrong. But on the other hand,
listening.
You're out there for a long time and you don't have a lot of resources. So interesting things are likely to happen anyway, even if the entire system does not collapse. And I feel like this is a story that hasn't been written.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So now I have to write it.
And it might be interesting to treat it like an epic history as well, because if you're going to follow this journey of a 500 years, I mean, that is, you could follow the descendants of the heroes that you were profiling, you know, in earlier volumes or chapters.
Oh, yeah, like a family drama.
Yeah. Like a Michener-esque type, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
You can have that one. That's for free.
Okay. I'll get on that.
Hey, I was going to ask you about, are you guys retired as far as SF Squeecast goes, or are you just on break?
We are all really, really busy, and we are on indefinite hiatus with the possibility of doing more live shows, I think is the... it actually became physically impossible to get everybody on Skype at the same time
A
monthly basis.
Sure. Your latest book is Care and Memory. It's available on Amazon and everywhere you can get ebooks, and I'm sure available physically as well. So go pick
last
that
time
up,
I checked.
Listeners. Yes. And where can people find you online?
Currently the best place to find me online is my Twitter account. As I said, my webpage is under construction.
Yes.
It's my Twitter account is MATOCIQUALA, and that's me everywhere. I'm a Google singleton, so I'm stuck with it forever.
Sure.
it was my Delphi account back in the day when I was desperately trying to come up with something that was unique enough for Delphi, which tells you how long I've been on the internet. And now I'm stuck with it.
Elizabeth Baer, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
I could talk to her all day.
Yeah. I mean,
we had to cut it off.
I know. I mean, just like her books are so like vast and like just varied.
The scope of them.
That's what I meant.
A lot of them are very like economical. Like it's 400 pages.
No.
It's
like I didn't mean like they're very
jest.
Long themselves.
Is Infinite Jest the new shorthand for a really long book? I feel like when I was a kid, it was like, this isn't War and Peace or anything.
Yeah.
But nobody says that anymore. Now it's like Infinite Jest or...
Although I still feel like War and Peace could still work. What was that really long one that you read recently?
The Instructions. And it wasn't recently. It was a couple of years ago.
Okay. It's a phone book.
I want to find that author and I want to strangle him.
I know.
It is an extremely long book.
But that has nothing to do with
no
Elizabeth
payoff
Baer.
At all.
But I just meant her books are there's so many diverse things that she tackles within science fiction and everything, which I just find fascinating. But
yeah, and what's amazing is that, sorry if I cut you off, I'll just parenthetical. She's not going like, oh, I got a bingo card.
No.
Like Ang Lee.
Right.
When he goes to direct a movie, I feel like he's got a bingo card that he's trying to hit every square. He goes, I'll do like a Victorian or like Edwardian romance. I'll do a comic book movie. I'll do a Western. You know, I'll do a sex drama set in the 1970s. And she's not doing that. She's just going, here's my story. It's going to have to do this, which means I'm going to need some of this. And also, I've been really wanting to do this. And then she finds a way to make a cyberpunk Western,
right,
you know, or a fantasy space story.
Or an alternate history that Cal might actually want to read.
Well, we'll see about that.
Which is quite the feat, if I must say so myself.
It's not getting nuts.
So, yeah, but...
Everything's an alternate history.
I suppose that's true to some
You know what
extent.
I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you could say that Thunder of the Barbarian, for instance, what was it said in, like, in the year 1990?
Right.
Comets came
so
out.
So far in the future.
Right. At this point, Star Trek is an alternate history because Khan took over the world in, like, 1992 or something like that.
Yeah, that's true.
And so every world that you look at could share a point of convergence with our world. Maybe... Mm-hmm. Harold didn't get shot in the eye with an arrow in the Battle of Hastings or something like that. And then, suddenly dinosaurs or something. We don't know.
Right.
But it's for me, it's when you call out and you say, this is an, I am Newt Gingrich. This is an alternate history novel.
Right.
Then suddenly it's, then we have to, it's, you have to track it back and you have to pay a lot of attention to what the point of convergence and then every other point after that.
Well,
and if you look at something like the Anno Dracula books, that's a little different, even though I didn't really like those either, because that's also like a literary pastiche. That's
right.
I'm just writing a book that is a celebration of Victorian like Gothic literature, and so
sure.
I'm going to try to jam Jekyll and Hyde and Dracula and everything else I can think of in there.
Right.
But I don't like having to track with. Okay, all right. So I guess we lost World War One, and so unless the entire thing is that like Man in the High Castle,
sure,
where you don't have to worry about what the point of whatever is, do you just know, you know, the Axis won World War II? We're talking about Bear.
Oh, yes. I mean, the alternate history thing, like, how many different authors have tackled, like the assassination of, like, JFK in alternate history? I just feel like that is one of the most common alternate history
tropes. One guy did.
Tropes.
His name is Gene Roddenberry. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Like Gene Roddenberry had like a huge boner for, you know, telling a story about Kirk going back to change the thing. And instead we got Harlan Ellison writing about saving Joan Collins, or actually not pushing Joan Collins in front of a car to save the world.
Wow.
Yeah, well, but and it became like shorthand, like I think among the producers like at Star Trek.
Yeah.
That whenever Gene wanted to get involved in something later, like the films or the later shows, the script that he would submit, you'd open it up, it'd be like, outdoor exterior, Dealey Plaza, 1960.
It's like, okay. Maybe he'd put a different name on it or a different color cover
Plaza.
Or whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Ooh, this is, we're using the blue paper, Dealey Plaza. Okay, yeah.
I know where I am.
Yeah. So I would encourage all listeners to go and check out her work. I have a specific one. I mean,
yeah.
Like we've said, her stuff covers a lot of sort of genres. We talked about this in the interview. I really like generation ship stories.
Yes.
And I also just like problems in space stories.
Problems in space.
I mean, I love Star Trek. I got a Star Trek podcast. But beyond that, I just like, you know, the haunted house in space.
Yes.
I just like that for some reason. I don't even
Absolutely.
Like haunted house movies, but I like it in space. I like monster movies in space.
Like, what is the movie?
Event Horizon.
Yes, thank you.
This is not like Event Horizon.
I
so
wanted
maybe this
to
is
say
bad...
The Expanse, even though I was thinking The Event
well, that's
Horizon.
That's cool, too. That's more
but that's
Game
different.
Of Thrones in space.
Yes.
That's true. It is kind of like Game
it
of Thrones.
It is like Game of Thrones in space.
But I want to recommend Dust, the first book for Jacob Ladder trilogy, or even the entire trilogy, which is a weird, fun blend of sci-fi and fantasy. It's set
cool.
on a generation ship that has broken down and gone wrong. And then, like we said in the interview, all good generation ship stories feature something going wrong. If something
right.
doesn't go wrong, then there's no story.
Yeah.
Except for the one that we came up with.
And yes.
I think, as long as I get a co-writing credit. But it's really great because there's sort of like nanotechnology involved and all the... you know, descendants of the people who live on the ship have all been altered by the technology that's in the ship to the point where the idea of it even being a ship is now a legend. They talk about like the pilots or the captains or whatever, which are almost like their gods, you know, the people of antiquity who before the world was broken, you know, knew the right way to go. And so it sort of follows, it's very fantasy in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me a lot of kind of I feel like there's like a Gothic horror type bent to it, or
sure.
not horror necessarily, but there's a Gothic bent to it. It reminds me a lot of like some of Gene Wolfe's stuff,
okay,
like his son, new son, old son, whatever it is, stuff. There's a, I think like there's some Titus Groan DNA in it too.
Okay.
And it just follows this young girl who meets this warrior from like another clan, and the clans are like, whoever the engineers are probably a clan now, and maybe the food service workers are a clan in some other part of the ship.
And janitors are a clan.
Yeah, and so they sort of get together and they go on this sort of quest to get to this place, and I can't really say all that much more, but there's a really great device in it, maybe about halfway through, where one character does like a tarot reading for another character.
Yeah.
And it's cool to, like, they're maybe hundreds, thousands of years in the future, but they still have this tarot thing. And it's always a good, as I was reading it, I was like, nice job, author, because you can always use that as a sort of a mechanic, you know, or a device to suggest what's going to happen.
Yes.
You know, whether you think that the tarot can actually predict the future or not. As an author, you know the future. You know what's going to happen.
Yes.
So you can layer in the significance of the reading yourself. And I just thought that was a really neat thing.
That is really cool.
Yeah, and check that out.
Somewhat the power of suggestion too, right? I mean,
possibly, yeah. Possibly. And I'd also want to plug again Karen Memory, her most recent published book that she described as Leverage with Hookers.
Yes.
And also Giant Robots or stuff like that.
It sounds awesome.
I also like Weird West stuff, so I would definitely check that out as well. It's available on Amazon. And like she said, her website's sort of being worked on, but you can find her online. And you can find her on Twitter at Matosiquala, if I'm spelling that right.
That sounds as right as
spelled M-A-T-O-C-I-Q-U-A-L-A. So go like her, follow her, check out her books. And thanks to Elizabeth Baer for joining us on the show. It's a good time. It's Lazarus. It's Image Comics. It came out in 2013. It is written by Greg Rucka and drawn by Michael Lark, who worked together previously for DC Comics 10 years before this came out on...
like Gothic Central?
Gothic Central. That sounds awesome. Yeah, it's Gotham Central.
Gotham Central, not Gothic.
Yeah, but that does sound cool, though.
Gotham Central sounds like a middle school in Gotham.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was going to say like Frankenstein and Dracula are cops.
Oh, okay. There
and they got to do the beat down in Monster Town.
Yeah, I can see that too.
Okay. That one's mine.
Gotham Central.
Don't take that one. And they work together.
See, I'm like, Gotham Central. It's like Saved by the Bell, but it's like the DC
it's
Young
all right,
class.
Because yeah. I'm Saved by the Bell. Would you stop derailing us? Okay. Back on track. So anyway, it is, they got together, they enjoyed working together previously, and they decided to do this book. And they were, I love reading the background of these things and hearing about all the cross-pollination. They were like spurred on by Ed Brubaker. He's like, yeah, that's a good idea. So you got, because Ed Brubaker probably almost came up with this on his own, and then he's like, all right, you take this one.
Right.
Because he and Rucka, I think they write similar stuff. They tend to like these crime-based sort of books.
Mm-hmm.
This is very similar. It's set in the future, and I would call it cyberpunk, but like cyberpunk and dirtpunk like together.
Yeah.
Like there is a world, because cyberpunk, what are you thinking? You're thinking Neuromancer. You're thinking, I mean, half of Neuromancer takes place on a satellite, so that's pretty technological. And later on, I think Gibson kind of corrects that, because a lot of his later books in the Sprawl trilogy, they're set in the fringes of this world.
Right.
And this is all fringe. Like the entire Force 4 issues, and I've read beyond this, continuing on, all take place sort of in the breadbasket in the middle of the country.
Right.
Which is now like a desert wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what's happened, if there's been some kind of ecological catastrophe, but we do know that there's been a huge sort of depression, if you will. And the nation's economy, the world's economy has completely crashed.
Yeah. And it's unclear like if it was like a natural disaster or man-made somehow or what it was.
Or if it was just a general decline.
Right.
Sort of a slide
into
this. Like
we depleted our resources.
Well, there are a lot of things that we're facing now, which I think makes this relevant, that could get us to a place like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Black Jacket blurb, you know, talks about how divisions between countries are no longer geological or like ethnic. They are economical.
Yes.
And the world is controlled by 16 different families.
And it's like a feudal system.
Right. And I think family. I think family is supposed to evoke a mob-ish sort of flavor. But it's more, the families are corporations. I mean, if this was Japanese, you'd call them zaibatsus or megacorps or whatever.
Yes.
But instead, they're families, because family plays a big part in this. And the main character who we join, who's named Forever, is a Lazarus. Mm-hmm. What that means is that she is a member of this family. All the ruling class, the heads of the quote-unquote family, are related, ostensibly, biologically. But she has been modified to be a super soldier. And as such, she is like a superhero whose only job mandate is to protect and enforce the rules of the family.
Yep.
She's like a Luca Brasi in a spaghetti tank top.
Pretty much. And she is... Write that down. Nice sniff. I do appreciate the way that Lark draws her for the most part. I mean, she is a buff lady.
Yeah.
She has a six pack. She has muscles on her arms. I really appreciate that.
And I also like the fact, I mean, she is literally objectified. Like, she is an object to her family. Because they all, and they talk about the sort of psychological manipulation that they do to her. At this point in the story, the first four issues, we don't really know the full relationship or how she sees herself. But we know that she sees herself as somebody who has to sacrifice. The beginning of the story, she is essentially killed. By these guys who break in and are trying to get seeds, we find out. They're trying to get food. So that's how desperate people are. And she's a Lazarus. She can be brought back. She can be rebuilt, you know, like the $6 million man. And it's painful and it's traumatic, but she sees herself as somebody who has to do this. While her siblings see her as a tool, as a thing.
As a thing that's not really part of her family. Yeah.
And
that
Lark
sort of
has talked about how, as an object and as somebody who is a super assassin that is, you know, tuned up, she has to be taken care of. She has to be, you know, they have to fix her wounds and stuff like that. And so she's going to be naked a lot, essentially, because she is a thing to them. Mm-hmm. But he's like, I didn't want to draw it in like a woohoo, like sort of titillating kind of way. So he's done his best to keep it from being, I think he says coy. Like, he's not trying to be like, well, maybe a little flash of ass there. Like, that's not what he's doing. And I think that he holds to that perfectly.
I think he does too.
To be dehumanizing and not like sexy hot.
Well, there is like, I found myself feeling like, oh wow, she's drawn like really busty. And then I was like, no, wait a minute. Maybe I'm being too critical. She's very athletic and she has large breasts. What do you want to say?
What? You've thought about it more than I have. I now have a reason to go reread it.
Stop. But there was one scene where she's visiting one of the scientist doctors. I believe his name is James, who is not part of the family, but who is very much intertwined into the intergoings of the family.
Right.
And like he's giving her a checkup or whatever, but her booty's kind of like tooched. And I was like, okay, maybe I was wrong.
Whoa, wait a minute. She's not strong. Female character.
But that's the only thing. And if that's the only thing, it's not really, you know who is
Eric
really...
Stevenson called them directly and said, you guys got to have one booty tooched in this or it's not hitting the stands.
And they're like, okay, here it is. Well, I mean, her sister, Joanna, she has two sisters and two brothers.
Yeah.
Her sister, Joanna, is definitely objectified, but she's supposed to be. She's supposed to be like the femme fatale and the seductress.
Yeah, right. All of her siblings are all sort of, this is the mob movie. This is where you meet all the lieutenants or whatever.
Yes.
Or the members of the family. And they're all conspiring against each other. This is the Godfather or what have you. And yeah, I mean, she's definitely fills that as the old... There's the brainy.
Yes, the brainy scientist.
Now we're breaking it. Hey, look, our discussion is a review, I guess. So now we're breaking it down. That's her one dimension. And then the other one is a sex bot, and that's her one dimension.
Yes.
So maybe not so good there.
And then Jonah is the scheming, slimy one backstabs and nobody trusts.
With his sister, Joanna.
Uh-huh. And it's suggested very early on that they have an intimate relationship with each other.
Sure. In this world, it's they control everything. They have a small number of people who work directly for them.
That are called serfs?
That are literally called serfs. Mm-hmm. Rucka didn't even think to come up with, or didn't want to come up with like a clever name for what they are. They are serfs. They essentially work the land that they are allowed to, and they're taken care of by the paramilitary forces that the family has, and other families. There are clashes between other families, and we'll get to that in a second. And then the rest are called waste.
Which is just really horrible.
And they are just, you know, total refugee type people.
Yeah.
And they factor greatly into later volumes. They become a big part of it. Because well, I know they're kind of mentioned. We don't really take the time in the first four issues to kind of dig down into what their thing is. But they do come back around in a cool way.
At the beginning of each issue, or like, I guess, each scene change, it would be like location, family. And it would give you like the number of family members.
Family.
I was waiting for you to do that.
Family.
I actually, every time I see that word on its own, it's in my head now. I know. So I open this up. It's like Lazarus.
We'll grow up someday.
but then it also, you know, it's like family, serfs, and then the number of serfs, and then waste, and the number of waste. So you get it.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that they don't like pound it in over your head. And it is, I think it's a good world building tool.
Yeah, it is. Something else that's great in the world building is that Lark works extremely hard on the art. And as far as I could tell, there's only specific things that Rucka sort of instructs him to do as far as the world goes.
Mm-hmm.
And he leaves the rest to him in terms of the technology, in terms of the background, the way things look. And he reportedly works 10 hours a day on this book. He used to do all the like the inking and like lettering himself, and he had to give that to somebody else because this book has kind of been perennially late.
Yeah, I read something about that.
They took a break a little while ago that was supposed to be for a couple months, and it turned into like 6 months just because they wanted to sort of get ahead of themselves, which is good. I don't mind waiting for good comics as long as I know that they're going to continue and not just peter out like a lot of good comics do.
Or come out like every 4 months.
Right.
Sandman.
Well, yes. But speaking of Sandman, or Sandman, that's a busy guy that's writing it.
I know.
And Ruck is a busy guy, too.
I know.
I mean, you're writing Wonder Woman, you're writing everything else you're doing. And if you're Lark, think about your life as an artist. And from what I understand, unless you are Sam Humphries, who writes like 15 books, nobody can survive like just writing or drawing a comic book. Like, that isn't enough money. So you have to do other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as an artist, when you're spending 10 hours a day on one project,
what else can you do?
That's all you can do.
Yeah.
And at one point, you're not going to want to spend 10 hours anymore. So they're still going strong, and it's the book's been good still. But yeah, I'm glad that they decided. At first, they said they were going to wrap it up in 100 issues. Now I think they're going to do it in like 60 or so.
Okay.
And so that's good. I say, especially with Image Comics, it's creator-owned.
Succinct,
nobody's going to drive it into the ground. You can do what you want. You set an endpoint, you say, we're going to get there.
Yeah. And then you can plan how you get there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like British TV, right?
Exactly.
Mean, like,
yes.
Sometimes less is more. You know, you have a certain amount of tools, you have a certain amount of time to tell a story, and then that makes you make more creative choices, like 140 characters on Twitter.
Right. Is that a great example? I would have said a sonnet, for instance.
Well, that too.
Yeah, fit the good stuff into 14 lines. But yeah, the modern sonnet.
Yes.
A tweet.
Exactly.
Oh, boy.
That's pretty good.
So as things continue here, Forever, who is also called Eve, I think, sometimes.
James calls her Eve.
Yeah.
He's the one. It's almost like he is more, tries to treat her more like a human than her family does.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly does. She is required to enforce her family's will. And this first comes out when they figure out that somebody inside the compound that was attacked had to have let the waste in.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically, company policy is somebody confesses and we kill that person or we'll kill everybody.
And she didn't want to do either of those.
No, she's very conflicted, but not enough to not do it.
Yeah.
And so an old man volunteers, and she knows, everybody, dogs know that this guy didn't do it, but she kills him anyway to satisfy the thing.
Yeah.
And then this becomes like the sort of thread that starts to unravel kind of the entire thing. She starts to chase this down, uncovers a plot by Johan and Johanna.
Is it Johan and Johanna? Or
I just thought that was what it was.
Okay. I thought it was Joanna and Jonah, but
or Jonah, yeah. Right.
But you know what? I think I like the way that you're saying it more.
Well,
it sounds
just say it
more
that
creepy.
Way.
Jonah, mob bossy,
and Joanna.
Yeah.
And they have a deal, or at least they're trying to cut a deal, it seems, with a another family in town. They send Forever to go talk to the main guy of this other family as a messenger. And so she goes out there. She meets another Lazarus, the Lazarus of this other family.
Yes.
And it's interesting. They have a kind of, it's almost like a Romeo and Juliet kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Because they're both people who are property. Like they're both people who are whose lives are completely controlled by the business that their family's in. But they saw each other like before when they were kids, mm-hmm. or she saw him. They haven't seen each other in 10 years.
Yes.
But it's sort of like two characters who are separated by stuff, and then they meet at like functions, or like we were at the crowning of the king, you know, 10 years ago or whatever. And so now they're meeting each other again. And we don't know at this point much about Eve. We don't know if she has normal emotions. She's always monitored for her reactions by her family to make sure that she's cool with killing people. But
and they give her so many pills.
Yeah. And we don't know what those do.
No.
And so she's talking to this guy, and there seems like there's a flirtation there. It seems
absolutely.
Like, yeah. And also, we don't know how old she is, because he says that she's 19, or she says that she's 19.
Yeah.
But we don't know if that's, she's accelerated, like an age.
That's a good point.
Like her body is manipulated, or because it doesn't, she
or
doesn't
she's
look
been
like a 19-year-old
for
to
a
me.
Long time. Or
if her body is just 19, but her mind is older. Yeah.
Right.
All good questions.
She said she was mature for her age when she saw
that's
her
true.
Last.
That's true.
But
that's what a 19-year-old girl who liked a guy and was talking to him would say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they kind of deal with each other. She gives the message and she heads home. And it turns out the whole thing's kind of been a trap by Jonah and Joanna, is that they've set her up. They're going to destroy her or try to kill her to make it look like the family did it. And so they can spark a war between the two families.
Yep.
And it goes okay. Kind of they blow her up. The other guy's there to see her off, the other Lazarus, and he gets blown up too, and they think it's all fine. And then Eve and these guys come to, you know, confirm the kill, and Eve and the other guy get up and just kick the shit out of everybody.
Because they're
freaking
awesome. Lazaruses.
Yeah,
what did you
awesome.
Think was going to happen?
I don't know what they thought was going to happen, but it does not work too well.
No, and Joanna, I'm just going to call her Joanna.
J and J.
Joanna and Jonah, like, it's really Joanna's idea to just destroy her. And she makes it sound so easy. Just cut her up into little pieces. Boom.
Right.
You know? And Jonah's like, it's not going to work and blah, blah, blah. But he, like, trusts her for some reason.
Right.
Because she's the sex pot. I don't know.
I don't know.
And then, like, it all blows up in their faces. And she just tells him to leave. And that she would take care of it. And then she has...
I feel like this is part of the plan.
Yes.
But I'm not sure how much of the plan it is, you know? Because, yeah, Jonah takes off and kind of takes the fall. And then Joanna has their bodyguard, like,
beat
her up.
Beat the crap out of her.
So she can tell the family that Jonah did it. And I'm not sure if that's her hanging him out to dry.
I think it is.
Or if that was their plan the whole time.
No, I think that's her hanging around.
But it's interesting because it doesn't matter, because even though... we get the sense that Forever loves her siblings, even though she doesn't always, like, trust them. She has this line to their father, who's also been running her sort of secretly, and he's like, so what's up? And she knows the whole thing. She's like, Joanna says that he beat her up. He ran off. I don't really trust him. It seems like they set the whole thing up, and she kind of knows what's down.
Yeah, but at the same time, it almost... she seems very sympathetic to Joanna being beaten up.
She is the last person on Earth that has any kind of empathy, it seems like.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
That would be the first thing they should try to breed out or genetically remove from her.
She has a lot of empathy for a killing machine. She really does.
Yes.
And she feels a lot. So, yeah. I think it's really cool. I want to keep reading it because I'm kind of curious. Like, I mean, you touched upon this too. Like, how much does Eve actually know about herself?
Yeah.
And does she know that she's enhanced, and to what extent? You know, they talk to her about her siblings do, about her being a machine.
Right.
I mean, does she think of herself like that?
Yeah.
And like when she's talking with the other Lazarus, something I really appreciated was there just was like just an instant like understanding.
Yeah, it's that thing where it's like on one of those British shows where the hoity-toity people are ordering the servants around and they're getting stuff, and then the servants go downstairs
yes.
and light up a smoke, and they're like, geez, Lord Fancy Pants is a little rough today.
Yep.
And they got their own thing going on. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But I really appreciated that, and there are some really nice moments in it.
It's that story of the puppet start learning to see its strings
mm-hmm.
and trying to figure out that, you know, they don't have quite as much control as they think they do. What do you think about, okay, Mr. Greg Rucka?
Yes.
He almost exclusively uses female protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
He is writing Wonder Woman right now.
Yep.
Got to start writing Whiteout, that book that got turned into the Kate Beckinsale movie, which wasn't so great.
Can't all be winners.
Yeah. And he's almost exclusively known for that. Stumptown, that yes. sort of thing.
I like Stumptown.
Well, yeah, I do too. What do you think about this?
Is
he a guy, like, we don't have him here.
No.
I swear to God that he will be on the show one day and we can ask him then. But until then, fill in the blank. Do you think that he just, if you had a guy, you have a creator, and yes. he only paints ladies, like, what would you think? Like, you don't got a landscape in you? Or what would you think about that guy?
I honestly think it depends.
Okay,
because
you're being as diplomatic as forever.
Well, look,
I'm just throwing it out there. Like, he almost all of his main characters are women. Now, we definitely need more women characters. Has he just said, I'm going to stand in the gap, I'm going to be the guy that brings all the women characters?
Maybe.
Or does he come up with a story, go, this could be anybody, but nah, screw it, let's make it a girl.
There might be some element of that.
Look, I mean, and this isn't criticism. I'm just trying to sort of plumb the depths of his sort of output here, like why he does this. Is
yes.
it that thing where you see this a lot in books now? Could be any kind of book, where you're describing something and you use a pronoun and you just use all her and she, use all female pronouns.
Yes.
Because why not?
Right.
Like, we've used he for about 1,000 years now. Since we've had printing in the West, I guess it's only been 500 years. So what the hell? We'll just flip it over and we'll just do she all the time.
Well, why
is it
not?
Like that? Is it, he comes up with a character? It's like this. I mean, we know that there are male Lazaruses. This character could be anybody, but screw it. Why not make it a girl?
Right. Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, what? I'm sorry. I'm trying.
I sound like I'm attacking, and because you seem like you're not ready to handle this.
No, I'm trying. So here's
I'm just speculating.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
I'm experiencing a brain fart, and I need you to help me out here.
I think it's well, I'll help you with your brain flatulence in a second, but
okay.
Mental flatulence. But because with Lazarus, I don't think it matters at all. But with something like Whiteout, you have a woman sort of police officer or detective or whatever who is in this situation where she has to order men around. And so that it's like Fargo, you know,
yeah.
Even though Marge doesn't really get a ton of pushback from people about being a woman, having a pregnant woman, no less, be put into all the situations that
yes.
that she's in, totally recontextualizes
trying
it.
To be come from a place of authority, but she's also putting herself in somewhat dangerous
right.
situations.
Like, she's just this pregnant, you know, sheriff's deputy from Fargo or whatever.
Yeah.
Who's up against these guys that put people in wood chippers. And so yeah. it immediately sort of shifts the way that you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But with something like Lazarus, I don't think it really matters. I mean, she could be a guy or a girl.
Well, she's like the little sister of the family. So it's like, not only is she the youngest sibling, she's a girl. So she's the one that they have to take care of, that they have to protect. But
okay.
we turn that on her head and she's the one protecting them.
We don't see it yet. But do you think that this world, which is very crappy and I think extends a lot of the things that we don't like about our current world to, like, it turns the dial to 11 on them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that a patriarchy is part of that? Because, like you
yes.
said,
it's run by her father.
It is run by her father. The other family that we see is run by a man as well.
Yeah.
But there are still there's women. You know, her siblings are
there are women, and they are powerful in their own way.
Although one of those women is using her sexuality almost exclusively as a
yes.
tool of manipulation.
Yes, and the other one is just kind of. She's not bad, but she's not like. One thing I thought was interesting was like when Forever is in serious danger and like her vitals are spiking and everything, and like Beth is just like fascinated by the science of it, and James,
right.
who's another scientist, is like, "This is your sister."
Is she okay? Yeah.
But she doesn't think of it like that.
Right.
So
object.
Yeah.
I'm good. I guess I went on a long run with the whole thing with the female protagonist thing, but otherwise, like, this is a pretty short kind of thing. I'm pretty much ready to go to the end if there's anything else you want to say.
Yeah, I just wanted you to help me with my brain fart.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
The artist who does really horrible skanky drawings of what's his name?
That could be anybody.
What's his name? We always he was giving
Frank Cho?
Yes, thank you. I was like, Cho, it's Cho. What is his first name?
Where are you
Chris?
Going with this?
I was just saying with the female characters, why? What would you think of somebody who draws only women? This is where I want to draw the line. Rucka shows women in a position of power and strong way. The women, female characters that maybe could be guys, but they're, guess what? They're women. Whereas Cho just objectifies ladies and sometimes just throws it in your face too if you're the guy who created Spider-Gwen. So, you know, that's what I just wanted to call that out. That's all I wanted to do.
Rucka draws with words female right. characters in many different ways, whereas Frank Cho, you can just different hair color, different yeah. costume, they're all the same.
It's just TNA all the time. So, yes. Yep.
TNA.
TNA.
Does anybody say TNA anymore?
I do. Maybe that makes me old.
I don't know what you'd replace it with.
I don't know either. But maybe whoever comes up with a better name for a strong female character could come up with a better name for a TNA.
Oh, they're working both sides.
Yeah, there you
go. You go. That'd be like if, you know, the same people who came up with, this is probably true. I think the same people who came up with MRA probably came up with SJW.
Probably.
In fact, I know that's true because wasn't SJW, maybe it's the other way around. One of them was an insult that the other group like wore like a badge.
Yep.
And I don't remember which is which. And I'm afraid to even look now.
I don't want to know. I really just I'm Switzerland.
Somewhere, Greg Rucka's ears are smoking, and he's just rocking, repeating to himself.
He's like, I just
wanted to make a cool comic book.
Exactly, and he did.
You guys did this. I didn't try to do this.
I would absolutely 100% recommend this. It's a really cool book. I really want to know where this is going. So I always feel like it's worth a two thumbs up recommendation.
Oh,
if
you only get one thumb.
Yeah, you get half a thumb.
Oh boy,
what happened to the other half? Anyways, you know, if I want to keep reading more, and I want to see where the story goes, I want to see where these characters go.
This thumb is wet because I've licked it, so I can turn the page. But that's right, you read it digitally, so now you just got smeared on your screen.
And I was.
I like
myself.
It too. I think that it's. Like I said, I mean, I think I've only read like the first 12 or so, and I always worry that it's going to just devolve into being real preachy.
Sure.
And so far it hasn't. You might not want to hear about things like this, and you can think that just bringing up like economic disparity is preaching. I know that you have to be careful when you say this word, but they looked at things like the Occupy movement to try to develop this story.
Okay.
Like what if... However you feel about Occupy, what if there was a world where literally 1% of the world controlled everything? And we're talking 0.001%.
Yeah, we are.
And everybody else is beholden to them. Like, they took things like that and took it to the nth degree. And just doing that is evangelism in a way, I think. And so as long as they keep telling that story in a way that unfolds organically and don't stop to have her turn to the camera and be like, have you ever seen such cruelty? Like, it's
right.
As long as they're not doing that, I'm on board.
Yeah.
That being said, though, the amount of work they put into this, Rucka's writing is always great. Lark is just his stuff is amazing. It's nice when we get to read like a good comic book. I'm not saying that we've ever read a bad comic book ever.
No.
But
never. Even by mistake.
It's a breath of fresh air too. So I would definitely recommend this one too. Legendary, the film company and also television company has optioned this for a TV show.
I saw that.
So here's your chance to get in on the ground floor as far as that goes, because this could be the next. This is sort of like Game of Thrones in the desert. You know,
sure.
Game of Economic Thrones.
Yeah, there you go.
And so, I mean, here's a chance to read this before it's the next big HBO or Showtime show that you are going to be drooling over every week. Think they'll still call it Lazarus?
I hope so. I don't know.
I feel like the title is the absolutely the most changeable thing about any adaptation.
Yeah, I kind of wonder
forever into a man named. Not at all. I never started. I was trying to make it the opposite.
I hope that they don't.
What's forever backwards? Revolf or something.
Yeah. That's really hacky.
Right. But the title could go in any second. I mean, look at Game of Thrones. The first book is called Game of Thrones. The entire series is called Song of Ice and Fire.
That's true.
They didn't want to call the show Song of Ice and Fire, so they just called it Game of Thrones
is stronger. The only thing with, like...
Don't tell George that.
Sorry, George. Lazarus, the only thing that's like... I don't know. I guess it kind of depends on how they market it. Because
people are going to think it's a religious thing?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And then that might come up with the
That'll
discussion.
Draw in a totally different crowd.
And then they'll be like, oh, no, this is not what I wanted.
I feel like Preacher hasn't done as well as people had hoped.
Yeah, I haven't heard as many people talking about it as I thought would be talking
I think it's
about
kind of
it.
On the bubble. And so maybe the religious connotation would have them go, let's just call it Waste or something like that.
Yeah, and then they could still be called Lazaruses within the show. It's just the show is not called Lazarus.
Yeah. So anyway, however that turns out, I'm sure it'll be great. But definitely check out this comic, Lazarus, from Image Comics. Okay, that was fun.
Yeah.
And like we said, apologies to Mr. Rucka for us putting you on the cross for a bunch of things that you didn't ask for.
We apologize.
But I think you came out okay. But going from something that, whether you like it or not, has political and sociological overtones.
Yes.
We'll go to something that has none of that.
Okay.
Has no such designs. I think that we should do a next wave.
Okay.
We've been out of the main Marvel world, DC, the big two or big three, if you will. I guess we just did Image. But we haven't done a corporate book in a while. And if you want a corporate book that... is so anti-corporate, it pretty much got canceled because it just couldn't toe the line and take anything seriously. That would be Stuart Immonen and Warren Ellis's comic, Next Wave.
Awesome.
So it's only 12 issues. They are quick reads, and I think that we should just do the whole thing.
Okay, let's do it.
Warren Ellis having fun.
Hey.
We want to know what that's like? This is what it is.
Yeah, I do want to know what that's like.
All right, well, come back next Friday then for Next Wave, issues 1 through 12.
Ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying?
Okay, we did it. It's always good to have a show where you come out feeling good.
Yes, I agree.
Smelling like a rose.
Mm-hmm.
We try to talk about the issues. We try to take things on and be honest about stuff. And sometimes that can be sort of a journey of emotional and intellectual discovery. And other times it's just like a mud bath and you need a Silkwood shower. And vaccinations afterwards. And you're just like, ugh. But talking to a really talented author and then reading a comic book by two talented guys. And so kudos to those gentlemen. Thanks again also to Elizabeth Baer for speaking with us. And we got to catch her again.
Yeah.
We'll definitely try to catch her at Convergence and see how everything's going.
Yeah, absolutely.
See if her website's up. Yeah.
I mean, I can relate. I mean,
I mean, our website's no great shakes, but you can find it at justenoughtrope.com, spelled just like it sounds. You can also find us on our social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, all the usual guys. Search for Just Enough Trope there as well, and you can find it. You can find us on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and search for Just Enough Trope, you can find our show page. And when you reach our show page, I'd ask that you would subscribe to the show. That is the easiest way for you to get the show. As soon as it's ready, it'll come directly to your little iDevice, my guy device.
Yes.
It better be. iDevices are the Lazarus families of the... they're like Taco Bell in Demolition Man.
Oh, my gosh.
The war ended and only iPod was the restaurant to eat at. Speaking of, my Zune, I've been having trouble with it.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It's crashed like 6 times now. And every time it crashes, you have to sort of like pull a deal on it where you rebuild it. And so, and I rename it every time. Like it's a new iteration, like Elizabeth Baer 3.3. I rename it. So whenever you plug it into sync, I see it's like, oh, it's Zune 8 or something like that. And then I always append like Zune 8. Are you effing kidding me? Like however I'm feeling when I have to do this again.
Right.
Well, the most recent time it crashed and I got the bright idea to try to reset the firmware, but it doesn't just like hard reset like a phone does. I don't know what Microsoft was thinking, but you have to reinstall the firmware. So I think no big deal. Plug it in. Guess what? yes, the Zune has been dead for a long time now, just as a brand, but they finally shut their servers down where you can get software from them.
You're kidding.
So I had to do this third-party workaround with like my own. I had to put my own server running to redirect the request to get the thing to the... But anyway, so it was extremely annoying. It took an entire day. It's back up and running now, but I was really mad.
Yeah. Borrowed time.
Well,
my goodness.
Yeah, it's time to think about something else. But I saw, instead of calling it Zune 9, I call it Zune the White now. It is returned. At the turning of the tide.
That seems positive.
Yes.
You know? It's bigger,
so hopefully
stronger,
it's got more
faster.
Powers. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a really fast horse. We'll see.
That would be great.
But forget all that. You're on iTunes, I guess. So leave us a review when you're there. We appreciate hearing from the fans. And also give us a rating while you're there. When you give us a high rating, we move up in the ranks. And that means that we get exposed to more people and more people get exposed to us. And we get to reach out to more people. We get bigger. You get bigger? Why not? Your knowledge of all the news that's fit to cast in the world of nerdy entertainment gets bigger as well. And so... that's what everybody wants.
Yes.
So while you're there, please give us 5 Sammy Davis Juniors.
Ooh, there you go.
Hey, babe. This podcast are the cat's meow.
No. That's not going in the pantheon with Vin Diesel and Stanley and everybody else. Keep working on that. Just give us 5 stars instead.
Sounds good.
Stars as big as Sammy Davis Jr.
Yes.
Joey Bishop, underrated.
You think so?
Yeah, I do think so.
Okay.
And then there's like the 2 or 3 other guys that nobody can remember their names.
And the rest.
There's, right, yes. Ooh, did the Rat Pack ever go to Gilligan's Island? They must have.
They must have.
All right, we'll look into that and we'll tell you about that on the next show. So that's it. I want to remind our listeners that on our next show, Craft of Services returns with Jingle All the Way.
Mm-hmm.
You say Schwarzenegger and Sinbad Bad. I said the last name, and then I was like, wait a minute, there's no last name.
No, he's just Sinbad.
Mr. Bad. Jake Lloyd and Phil Hartman are in it as well. And at this point, Phil Hartman's career is doing better than Jake Lloyd's career. But we can talk about that when the show happens. And then, of course, next Friday, we're doing Comic Book Club again. Next Wave, as I said. You can get Next Wave online. You can also get it in a physical copy. Maybe. I don't think they print them anymore, but you can probably still find one somewhere. So go online. And here's my thing. If anybody has it, either digital or physical, it's going to be on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And if you go to Amazon, first go to our website at justenoughtrope.com. If you click through the banner, you can get to Amazon, and nothing has changed. It's like you went into the mirror universe in Doctor Strange or whatever, however that works, I don't know. And when you buy something, we get a little piece of that.
Right.
We get our beak wet on that, as they say. And it helps to keep the lights on here, and it costs you nothing more. Nothing has changed for you,
mm-hmm.
except surreptitiously some money has gone to us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's for a good cause, though.
That's right.
It's not as underhanded as I'm making it seem. So please do that. You can also bookmark that link. So anytime you go to Amazon, be it for Cyber Monday deals, Black Friday, Christmas shopping, whatever you're doing, buying those glasses that say 2017, that's going to be a tough one to pull off for the sunglasses. But anything you buy from Amazon, if you go through our link, it helps us out. So we'd appreciate that. That is it. All the ads are done and we can finally leave. So we're going to sign off. I'm your host, Caliban.
I'm your co-host, Mikan Hanna.
Keep the geek fires burning.
And these visions of Johanna are now all that remains.